Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Where's day two of Australian Open relived? I'm not sure we can live up to day one because I've not really been able to think about much else since we recorded that show about Yvonne Goolagong-Cawley, Catherine. She's almost made me want to look up more stuff about her, and listening to people that have responded to that show and written to us, it feels that she's really got under the skin of everybody who's remembered her, who particularly people that were around at the time, which is, I suppose, kind of the whole point, really, isn't it?
Yeah, Pat Roberts is all of us, apparently.
I'm not sure she's listened yet.
Oh. Ooh.
My mum tends to be a day behind with the podcasts.
All right. That's good. I drew attention to somebody that I know who I'm sure will be interested in that show over in Australia. And he said, yeah, I'm a bit busy at the moment. I'll probably get around to it about March. But I promise I will watch it. I will listen to it. But anyway, it was a pleasure to do it. And we have more for you today because we're fast-forwarding a few years from Yvonne Goolagong-Cawley's time at the top and her winning Australian Open titles in the 70s. We're going through into the 80s in particular to concentrate on. But really, the whole idea of this show is we wanted to cover the history of the tournament and its movement from Kooyong to Flinders Park, now known as Melbourne Park, in the years 1987 and 1988. We've spoken to Pat Cash, we've spoken to Pam Shriver, both of whom were very significant figures at both of those tournaments. I don't really think I realised it when we first came up with the idea to speak to them, Catherine, that they had both won both, or they'd both been in the finals of both tournaments, Pam having won them both. I mean, but then she just used to win everything with Martina Navratilova.
Yeah. It's interesting. It was obviously heralded, and we'll come on to talk about it a lot. There's this huge seismic change for the Australian Open, not just the change of venue, but perhaps even more significantly, the change of surface and the change of balls that we'll hear Pat Cash come on to talk about. So the fact that there was so much consistency in the eventual results, I guess, what does that tell us? I guess it tells us that the greats are great for a reason. And
champions are just.
Is it champions are just? Yes.
Well said, Matt. Yeah.
Yes.
Well said.
Which was a phrase that was busted out on the Whitaker WhatsApp group yesterday when Billie Jean, who's with my brother at the moment, she's getting very cold on her walks because puppies do, and it is very cold. And her cable knit jumper that I've ordered for her, because she refuses to wear her coat that I bought for her because it's too big. And I love it because it makes her look like a superhero, but she is not a fan. So anyway, I've ordered her a cable knit jumper. It hasn't arrived, and she had to go for a walk. And Math fashioned for her a tea towel coat with the caption, champions are just.
Was he referring to himself for coming up with that idea, sure, or for Billie Jean?
Catherine's got a little reminder on her phone that makes sure she says champions are just on a daily basis now.
Yes.
Let's go back in time and remember the origins of the Australian Open, which began its life in 1905, 116 years ago, on grass at the Warehouseman's Cricket Ground in Melbourne, now known as the Albert Reserve Tennis Centre. I was a little bit taken aback to find out that it wasn't always played at Melbourne. In Melbourne, it was staged
Or indeed in Australia.
Indeed. Well, it was, I mean, because it used to be known as the Australasian Championships and factored in New Zealand for a few years. But in Australia, it was also staged in Sydney, Adelaide, Brisbane and Perth. It attained Grand Slam status in 1924. But, I mean, we've covered it in parts with Billie Jean King and talked about it separately, but it often just wasn't populated by the top players. There were so many players that just didn't take part. Part of that was obviously geography and back in the day and difficulty getting there. The dates we've talked about, sometimes it was played in December and either side of Christmas, which wasn't always ideal. But as Billie Jean King was telling us, the professional game was beginning to thrive at that time, and yet the Australian Open and all the Grand Slam tournaments remained amateur. So there was that discord between the two, and it ruled out a lot of these top players. In 1970, for instance, several big names didn't play at all because they were employed by the National Tennis League, the professional game. People like Rod Laver, Ken Rosewell, Andres Gimeno, Pancho Gonzalez, Roy Emerson and Fred Stolle meant that they just didn't enter the Australian Open, didn't offer sufficient financial guarantees for them. So that tournament in 1970 was won by Arthur Ashe on the men's side, and Margaret Court won the first leg of the Grand Slam, the calendar year Grand Slam. And I was quite taken aback to find out that at that point, Billie Jean King, who'd been in the last two finals at that point, then went on a 12-year hiatus from the tournament. She just didn't play the tournament for the next 12 years. She did come back and play in the early 80s a couple of times, but she was in her prime in the 70s and just didn't play the tournament. And 1970 would have been the ninth of Margaret Court's 11 titles. So from 1972, it did set up a permanent home for the next 16 years. It was played in Kooyong, and Steve Tigner, the writer for Tennis Magazine and Tennis.com, he wrote about that period of the game and history, that the 1970s was the decade of the Pro Tour invasion. In those days, the momentum was with the ever-expanding circuits. They were played in modern arenas for big money and had hopes of competing with the world's major team sports. The Grand Slams, by comparison, were still played in creaky private clubs built in the early years of the century and were run by the game's even creakier old amateur guard. The majors looked like a relic from tennis's fast-vanishing past. Nowhere was this more true than at Melbourne's Kooyong Stadium, site of the least grand of the slams at the time, the Australian Open. By the early 70s, the sun was setting on that country's 20-year run of dominance. The stars that took the Aussies' place were from almost exclusively from the US, Europe and South America, and they were happy to avoid what was then a late-season trip down under. The tournament was played, as we've talked about there, in December for much of the 70s and 80s. And get these for a few stats. Bjorn Borg played the Australian Open in 1974, never came back. Jimmy Connors made the trip twice, in 74 and 75. Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova each made one appearance in the mid-70s before skipping it until the early 1980s. And not only was the Aussie Open an inconvenient location at an inconvenient time of year, the main court at Kooyong had an inconvenient incline at one end. We'll hear more about that from Patter in a little while. Imagine that. It's basically you're playing on a slope. By the 80s, though, Steve writes,
it can't be inconvenient for both players.
That's a very valid point, Catherine. In fact, there are certain football teams that manage to get big old FA Cup runs out of a sloping pitch. I'm looking
well,
at
you change ends.
Well, but at any one time.
Yes.
For exactly. Somebody, it must surely be a great convenience.
Imagine if you were a slope specialist and you just cleaned
up. Isn't Suzanne Longlin on a slope?
Just going to say that. I think there's a story about Suzanne Longlin being sloped. Yes.
Mm.
Oh, excellent.
So someone somewhere maybe has stats on who has the best winning percentage on Court Suzanne Longlin. But that person is not me.
I mean, I could say it's probably Nadal.
Yeah, played there twice, won there twice.
So Steve Digner writes, by the 1980s, the old guard had weathered the professional storm and was prepared for a counterattack. World team tennis, the biggest threat to the game's traditional calendar and the major's place at the heart of it, had folded in 1978. That same year, the US Open moved from the overcrowded Westside Tennis Club in Forest Hills to a much larger public facility and a new court surface at Flushing Meadows, where, of course, it's now played today. The French Open, led by longtime amateur official Philippe Chatrier, began a revamp and expansion. Perhaps its most beloved court, the Bullring, opened in 1981. Change came slowly at Wimbledon, but it eventually came as the famously authoritarian event began to cultivate a friendlier relationship with its players. Yeah, it's hard to believe what it used to be like compared to what it is today. But what about the Australian Open?
That's written by Steve Tigner. It's not Australia calling another nation authoritarian, is it?
Back in the day, Catherine, they might have been able to. The Australian Open, as we have said, was at Kooyong from 1972. And then in 1988, it moved to Flinders Park. Now, rather than me telling you anything more about that, let's hear from somebody who remembers it crystally clear. And that's Pat Cash. He can tell the story better than any of us. He reached the men's singles final of the last edition of the tournament in 1987 and the first edition at the new venue in 1988. So basically you're talking right at the heart of his career. He was the Australian hope. Of course, they hadn't won the men's singles since Mark Edmondson all those years earlier. And his two finals, I noted, came either side of his Wimbledon victory as well. So first of all, before that move to Melbourne Park, and he can tell us all about that, let's hear from Pat Cash about what Kooyong was like.
Kooyong had an amazing history. I mean, I was from Melbourne, of course, and, you know, it was always regarded as you know, the home of tennis. It was a club, a private club. I suppose you could say it's Australia's version of Wimbledon. It was quite an exclusive private club with, you'd say, slightly respectable, more elderly members at the time. Lots of courts. You know, we had all the Davis Cup, big Davis Cup matches there, and that was, you know, it was the main stadium. It was an old, very big, very round stadium where you could fit three courts in the center court. And what they used to do is rotate the court. So you'd play 5 days on the left side, 5 days on the right side, and then the last 5 days, 4 days in the middle. And it was quite low cut. There was only like two tiers, except for some of the Davis Cup matches and in the past. In the 1950s, they used to put up another tier right up the top, which would have been pretty scary up there. But it was just so popular, the Davis Cup for Australia, that they used to put an extra tier on for some of the legends, the big names that we – Frank Sedgman and Rosewell and those sort of guys used to sell it out. That was the biggest ticket in tennis. And the wind used to swirl through there. The courts were very, very quick and hard. I mean, it's sort of a bit like if you were a cricketer, you would say that's a typical Australian sort of cricket pitch. Grass courts that were fast and bouncy. Not necessarily the best, the most even grass courts, but there was a very basic changing locker rooms. Very basic. There's some really simple ones underneath the stadium. You know, it was cement. It was looked old. I mean, you look at it now and you think, oh, wow, that was sort of, and they're all wooden benches. So it used to be stinking hot with no protection there. And the court itself wasn't actually flat. So it was cambered down the ends. So you'd be serving, and the net in the middle was actually, I'm not sure if it was 2 or 3 inches higher than a normal net. So you'd be serving uphill, and the opponent would be just on the going downhill, which made it really tricky. But it was an advantage for the Australians if they could, if you could get used to it. But, we weren't of massive height back in those days. If you were a Pelka or Isner or something like that, you'd have a massive advantage because you got so much height. But it made it kind of tricky with very, very tricky conditions, windy with that sort of net, fast and bouncy and slightly odd bouncing grass courts. It saw quite a lot of unusual wins and different sort of champions that came through under those conditions.
Mm. Did you go there at all before you were a player? I mean, obviously this tournament had been played there for many, many years. I imagine your childhood, but certainly your younger years.
No, absolutely. As a kid, I was there. I had my very first tennis lesson there. So my father wanted me to get into tennis, and he thought, well, Kooyong's a place to go. And I had a tennis lesson right down the back there, not on the grass courts, on our version of clay. When the tournament was on, there's a railway track that goes along the side. There's a Kooyong train station, and we used to get on one end, and we used to run across the train track and sneak in the club for free that way. Just about every kid knew there was a entrance. There's a little fence that you could do that. Run across the track, sneak in the back entrance, and wander up, and you'd be in, not in the center court, of course, but you'd be watching the outside courts. And there were plenty of outside courts there, and they had these low sponsors' hoardings, you know, in sort of plastic. Marlboro was the cigarette company was a big sponsor there, and it was, I remember the red and white. I remember it so clearly, seeing some of the Aussie players, and you could get right up close to them. It was just a great experience for me and my tennis mates to sneak in and for free, of course, as long as we didn't get caught.
Just fast forward into when you reached the final. I was looking at your results that year, and you didn't have any straight sets wins at all. It was really hard fought to get to that final on grass, which was a stark contrast to the next year when you had a straight sets all the way to the semis. But in 87, what was it like in terms of the atmosphere around? I mean, how did Australia, did you feel, take to you? I mean, this was before you won Wimbledon, but you were a pretty big name.
Yeah, right? Well, the Davis Cup final, the 1986 Davis Cup final, was over just after Christmas. So the Australian Open was obviously in the middle of January. The Davis Cup, which was massive, of course, we beat Sweden in 86, and I had a couple of real tussles with the Swedish guys. That was our real big build-up. So I'd had a great comeback against Michael Pernfors, who played really well, beat Stefan Edberg as well, but we managed to sneak the Davis Cup win. I played all three matches back-to-back, actually. I played the second match, first doubles, and then the first single. So I was next to exhausted, I ran myself into the ground and got the flu. You know, went on holiday for a few days and then just sort of got run down, as you do when you're stressed. And then all of a sudden you relax. You tend to get your nervous system, immune system seems to shut down. So I asked them to push it off, push back my matches as long as I could possibly put them back. And so I came into the tournament with hardly any practice, though I'd had plenty of tennis, you know, the months before. So they pushed it back to literally the last match that they could possibly put. And so I had a crammed schedule. And as you said, I was a bit rusty to start with. And I sort of fought my way through to, the quarterfinals playing Noah. Very windy day where I damaged my shoulder. It was good enough to get through Lendl. As I said, it was a quick grass court. So that was a big advantage to me. And of course, the crowd were pumped. You know, I was Australian Davis Cup hero. Along with my teammates, of course, it was a team effort, massive team effort. But you know, I was the guy they thought, you know, could finally win the Australian Open again. That's since 16 years or whatever it was before. And so, you know, I had plenty of support behind me, and I made my way to the final. And Stefan Edberg, who I'd beaten in the Davis Cup final, was obviously looking to some form of revenge against me.
Yeah, of course. And it was a heck of a final. I've just been watching some of the highlights. Have you ever seen it back since?
I have seen some highlights actually reasonably recently because I'm coaching a player and I wanted to. She had no idea what I played like, so I had to dig some out on YouTube. It was a really interesting match because you if you have a look at it now, people go on and watch it, you say like a very windy day with a really quick and quite uneven grass court. You can see how myself and Edberg were, and I wasn't serving particularly well because of my shoulder, so I was just sort of getting the serve in and running as fast as I can, I was never debating defaulting the match, but I wanted to somehow get a painkilling injection into my shoulder just to survive through one day. I mean, I could barely lift my arm, but I got some physio on it and got out there, and Stefan just destroyed me in the first two sets. My reserve was just, not up to speed, but I was able to put a little bit more onto it in the third set and got the third set. And then the fourth set, I don't know what happened with him, but he started fading away, and I was up a double break. And end of the fourth set, I'm thinking, for the first time, I thought, well, I was just happy to be out there playing. There's no way I could win this match. I'll just give it a shot. And all of a sudden, I thought, wait a minute, if I get through this fourth set quickly enough, I'll lead into the fifth and final set with a bit of momentum. Unfortunately, my shoulder went completely dead, and I served, I don't know exactly what it was, but after being 5-2 up, I think I served 4-3 double faults in one game, 4 double faults in the next game. I end up winning the set, but the momentum was gone and it shifted to him. And he got a break sort of midway in the fifth set and finished it out. So, in my matches, in my career, I see that, even though at the beginning of it, I said I was happy just to be there and compete. I feel like that's the one that got away. I really do. I thought if I could have just finished off that set, I could have got some momentum in the fifth set, and Stefan was pulling his hair out at that stage, but it wasn't to be.
That was the final match, I guess, ever played there as the Australian Open.
Yeah, it was.
And the tournament moved. How did it feel to you at the time? Did it feel as somebody who played Wimbledon and the other Grand Slams? Did it feel that this needed to happen to you?
Well, we wanted a good big tournament. We felt the Australian Open needed an upgrade. And at that stage, some of the players were starting to come back. They messed around with the dates a little bit and tried various dates. They tried it before Christmas, which was, I suppose, the last Grand Slam of the year. Nobody really came out. Then they tried it just after Christmas. Of course, nobody came out then. And then they moved it back to mid-January and the players started turning up. So the last year, we had Lendl, we had McEnroe, we had Becker, we had all the players. There was a big, big tournament, but it still didn't have quite the prestige. And I think Tennis Australia realised they needed that. So we wanted to keep it on a fast court. So we were really sort of fighting to say, well, Kuyong, can you build the stadium up? Can you make a bigger stadium? And the members were very slow doing that. It was only really when they realised that the Victorian government had decided to put millions into it and build on an empty railroad terminal right near the centre of town and build this massive big stadium, which was multi-purpose closing roof, which they could put concerts and whatever else, festivals in their music, that they could afford that this had some value and it could get their money back because the Kuyong was, it was a tennis event. It was a tennis club and that was it. There was nothing really much on there, though. There did have some famous concerts back in the day. Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath used to play there until the neighbours, of course, complained because it was very residential there. But, so Melbourne Park, which was Flinders Park at the time, was created. And we were very excited about it. What we really wanted was our own surface. So we trialed some different surfaces. There was some synthetic grass brought in, which was just the most terrible surface ever invented. Great for rainy days. It's probably great for Northern England or Ireland where it rains a lot of the time because it absorbs the water because it's really sand onto plastic grass. But that didn't work. And they said, well, we've got this surface called Rebound Ace, which was a rubberized surface, which I thought was great. It's hard court, but a lot of rubber on it. It's Australian made. softer on the knees and the body because it had extra rubber on it, but played like hardcourt. And when it got hot, it had some different characteristics, very bouncy. And I thought, well, the biggest concern we had, and we said, we don't want the Swedes and the Czechs to come in and start dominating. And this is before the Spanish came in and started, you know, dominating tennis with their baseline game. We really said, we don't want the Swedes and the Czechs to come in and start dominating the Australian Open. We want a service that suits our style of play. So that was created a rebound ace, which is really hard court, but a fast version of that. And, you know, we were excited about it. Leading into the tournament, it was a beautiful venue. We knew it was going to be fantastic and we were very proud to have it. But the only thing that they really screwed up on was the balls. Now they had to use these balls called Nassau balls, which were Korean balls. Now the Seoul Olympics was coming up and the Seoul wanted their home brand ball to be used, and they basically bought into the Australian Open. And part of the rules for the Olympic Games was that the ball had to be of Grand Slam, it had to be played in Grand Slam, and it had to be of certain quality. Problem is, the year one, they didn't manufacture the ball properly. It was a flat ball. You could almost squeeze it in halfway. So here we were with a fast court, Australians, you know, serve and volley with ridiculously slow, flat balls. So the balls didn't bounce. They didn't bounce. So the bouncy, fast grass court that we've been playing on, we said, well, we want the same, but in this new stadium, all of a sudden, the ball wasn't bouncing. So we didn't have that. We lost that advantage. And they originally wanted to change the balls at 9 and 11. Normally it's 7 and 9 because of two games for the warm-up. They count two games of the warm-up. And I stood up and the press conference and said, these balls are just not up to standard a few days before the tournament. And, of course, that made a few headlines. Luckily for me, Martina Navratilova, who was the defending champion, I think she was a defending champion, but she stood up as well and certainly defending Wimbledon champion like I was. And she said, yeah, the balls are not up to quality. They need to be changed more often. So we had at least normal ball change. But I could say that at that stage, when I first hit with the balls, I just, without really thinking, in the back of my mind, I said, there goes my Australian Open chances. There's no way you can beat a great baseliner with these conditions. But I gave it a hell of a shot.
You sure did. I mean, you as I said earlier, you went on a run of straight sets wins all the way to the semis. Then you had another massive tussle and then another one in the final. I mean, first of all, did it now feel, I don't know whether it's right to say like a Grand Slam because it was a Grand Slam before, but did it feel a significant move on the first day you stepped into Flinders Park, now Melbourne Park, and played your first round, for instance?
It felt like the best tennis stadium in the world. I mean, it really did. Because we, you know, if you look at the US Open, their stadium was still Armstrong. That was an outdoor, not particularly nice stadium. Wimbledon, of course, is Wimbledon. It's great prestige. The French Open, they have a nice, great centre court, but they didn't have, you know, a 16,000 stadium with closed roof that you could close if it was raining. And so we felt, and rightly so, that even though they didn't have all the big outside courts they do now with closing roofs, we felt, and we had loads of land. That was the other thing. We knew that we could just keep building and building more stadiums. And when I say we, I mean Australian tennis. So we did feel, and we wanted that news to get out that, actually, in actual fact, we've leapfrogged every stadium there is. And, of course, we're never going to have the prestige of Wimbledon, and maybe that's going to still be ahead of us. But they didn't have the Court 1 either. They had a pretty average, you know, the old Court 1 was there. So we felt that we had the best tennis stadium in the world, and I think we did. We had the best, and it's still to this day. And it's expanding, and it is the best tennis stadium for a Grand Slam.
Yeah. How did you feel within yourself, because you were going in again as the guy who had so nearly won it the year before? You'd won Wimbledon as well, so I imagine that there is more expectation still on you to deliver. As you said, it's Mark Edmondson all those years ago that has won the Australian Open, and nobody's done it since. How were you feeling within yourself?
Pretty confident. You know, I was playing good tennis, but you've got to play some great tennis. It was interesting. The very first match, they wanted me to play a night match. They wanted me to play the very first ever Grand Slam night match, which was an honor. You know, it's going to be a bit of a ceremony and all that sort of stuff. And I said to them, no, I want to play outside. They said it's going to be 40 degrees or 39 degrees outside in the daytime. Don't you want to play at night? I said, no, I want the court as fast as I possibly can because of the balls and I said, I'm a bit worried about the player I've got to play first round. You know, he's a good player. He's coming through really quickly. And they said, you don't worry about him. You know, you'll beat him easy. I said, no, look, I don't want to take any risks here. I want to play this guy called Thomas Muster, who, of course, ended up being number one player in the world. But they didn't really know him, but I knew him. We all knew how good this guy was. And so I wanted to play in the boiling hot, fast as possible conditions. There was also, unfortunately, the president of the Tennis Association had a lot of pressure on him because I'd been to South Africa and played the year before. I had to go down there to qualify for the Masters. I had to go down to Johannesburg. The last tournament of the year, myself and Brad Gilbert were chasing the Masters or the ATP Finals spot in New York. And we both went down there to try and get it. I was number 9 and he was number 8. And it was the last tournament of the year. We went down there. We ended up playing each other in the final. And I ended up winning it in 5 sets to get myself into my one and only time I ever been in the ATP Finals. But that wasn't very that was a very popular decision. So the protesters just wanted to in a match, and they made a deal. The president made a deal that they could interrupt my match on my serve and come in and throw black tennis balls onto the court, which I knew there was going to be some form of protest, but they didn't really tell me what was going on. And he allowed that. And I thought, well, my goodness. I mean, there was, you know, but it was my focus was, okay, something's going to happen. When it does happen, you know, switch off and just get into the match. Obviously, they wanted me to lose because they were protesting what I did down there. So they were doing their best to interrupt me at a very crucial time in the match. But, you know, so that was another interesting incident where I was sort of the hero. But, of course, people were making it quite aware that, you know, my move down to South Africa was not a great thing. But, you know, I got through Muster in straight sets, and as you said, and I was in some very good tennis form. But there's a lot of good players in a tennis tournament.
There were. When you went all the way, I mean, I'm just you described earlier as the 87 final as the one that you feel that got away, and yet the final that you ended up playing against Mats was that went all the way and in the fifth set.
Yeah.
How does that feel different if it does at all?
I think I was sort of I think in that match I never really against Mats I never really had massive momentum. What happened was it was like another typical Melbourne day. It was windy, blowing around. Forecast was that there was going to be some rain. So I knew there was a possibility of some rain delays. Mats got out of the blocks pretty well, got me up a set and a break, and then it rained, which was great for me. So I went in and I came back and I broke back, won the set, and won the next set, and it was I was up a break in the next set. So it was almost exactly flipped around completely the other way. And, you know, I was really on top at that stage. And the rain came. So I broke my momentum, and then you will know that when we talk up together on Five Live on the radio, how adamant I am about medical timeouts and all these things breaking up momentum. I mean, this is just a classic case. Sport is all about momentum, and here I have the Australian Open final. One rain delay certainly helped him. One rain delay certainly helped me, or the other way around. When he came back out, it was a real tussle. Yeah, I got the serve out the third set, and Mats played really well in the fourth set, and I was a bit flat. You know, after the big match against Ivan Lendl, beating him in 5 sets, the world number one, it was on the 26th of January, which was Australia Day. Then it was celebrated. Australia won some. I'm not sure what cricket match it was. It was literally at the MCG behind us there, a big one-day match against, I think it was, might have been against the English, but it was a big game. And I just felt a little flat, so Matt came at me. So, getting into the fifth set, he certainly had the momentum. So I never really had a chance to get on top like I did in the 87 when I was clearly in the lead. But, just the serving, the shoulder went dead. Against Matt, it was just nip and tuck the whole way. And he got up early break in the fifth. I broke back, played some really good tennis to get back. And, he broke my serve at 7-6. Yeah, I think 7-6 in the fifth set and served it out. So, I walk away from those matches going, they're heartbreakers. And I literally, every time I walk into Melbourne Park, it breaks my heart a little bit. Say that I'm not one of those guys that his name is on the, and I came so close twice. But that's the way it goes. And I can honestly hold my head up and say, I played just about as well as I could. Given the circumstances, you're never going to be 110% fit in a final. You played a long 2 weeks of tennis. And, considering everything, I played pretty well. And I can walk away from that going, those were beaten by two better guys who were just a fractionally better twice than me on 2 days.
I get that now. Here you are many, many years on and you can reflect on that. I just wonder how you would have felt at the time, because one of the themes that we've come across in reliving all of these great matches from the past, so many times the defeated finalist does an interview on court or does a speech and says, or is told, you will win this one day. And that's it's obviously a lovely sentiment, and it's one the crowd gets involved with, and they feel sorry for the person who's lost, and it seems, especially, I mean, you would have been what, 23, 24, something like that, and it looks like you've got all these years still ahead of you.
Yeah.
Did you assume or believe that this title was going to be yours one day? I mean, you've reached the last two finals.
No, not at all, really. It actually took the stuffing out of me that year, 2 years, and I'd come back from some bad injuries. So it took a massive effort to get back from some injuries. I was a young father, so I was dragging my family around the world as well, my two kids. To be honest, I just ran out of gas, and I kind of needed a year off. And then the way life has it is that, I broke my Achilles tendon, and that was sort of the beginning of the end. So, I had a couple of good years, but look, another little caveat to the end of that match and certainly the victory speech. When I lost to Stefan, they asked me to come and make a little speech at the last at Kooyong, and my wording, I suppose, wasn't unintentional, but it wasn't meant to be bad or anything, but. I got out and I said, thank you, thanks for the sponsor, thanks for the tournament and all that. And I said, look, I'd like to thank, and the sponsor was Ford Motorcars there. And I said, look, I'd like to thank Ford and all that junk, but I'm going to leave that to Stefan. Anyway, Ford got upset because I called them junk. And it kicked up behind the scenes a storm, and I wasn't being supported by Tennis Australia. Pat, you've got to do this. This is what you've got to do. You've got to write an apology. I said, it was just a term of phrase. I didn't call them junk. I just said the junk, as in he'll do all the speeches. He'll do all the thanks. Oh no, that's not the way they said it. They're thinking of pulling out of the tournament. All this sort of stuff. And I said, in no certain terms, get stuffed. I'm not doing it. So when I got to the final. That next year, they said, "Do you want to come up and say a few words?" And I said, "No, I'm not going to say any words because you guys, Tennis Australia, you didn't support me at all. And you could have done it. So I didn't actually, probably the only runner up in history not to actually get up there and say any words. And so I was pretty up. I was pretty exhausted and I was pretty upset because I'd played a match, unbelievable match, and here I was lost two times in a row, but." Matt and I are good mates, and there's a lot of media and all that sort of stuff you do after the match. It was because they closed the roof, so that was the first time their final had been closed. So the second time after the second rain delay, they closed the roof. So it ended up finishing pretty late. And, you know, we had you know, some clothes, and we decided to go up to what was a bar nightclub, which was most of the tennis players were up there. And then we said, well, let's just go to get a drink on the way home, you know, and forget about things. I went with my team, and as it turned out, Matt was there as well. And we had a drink together, and, you know, in actual fact, I remember it pretty clearly, but, you know, I came in there and I saw Matt's, and he had his group and I had my group, and there's a bunch of players around, and they have end of the tournament, they have a celebration. And I think everybody sort of looked at me and then looked at Matt's and said, oh, what's going to happen here? Because we're good mates. So, you know, I went up and it was almost like you walk into the Western movie, you know, a guy crashes through the bar and everybody goes silent and they just turn their heads, turn. It's like a comedy movie. What's going on? And I sort of just grabbed my drink and I said, here's to the Australian Open champion. Well done, Mats. And we had a cheers when we had and people clapped their hands and we had a laugh. And, you know, we've been great mates. We always have been, and we're still great mates.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Well, it's a lovely story, isn't it? And it's one of many that Pat told us about in that interview. I mean, when we were listening to that just now, Catherine, you just said, particularly around the Ford story, you said classic Pat Cash story, because it is really, isn't it? I mean, first of all, a guy who, well, we're both very fond of. We've worked a lot with him over the years, and I personally, I really like Pat a lot. I've got a lot of time for him, but he doesn't half put his foot in it sometimes. But, you know, it's just who he is.
Yeah, that is kind of the definitive Pat Cash story. Sort of just inadvertently wading into some quicksand, and then once you're in it, go, well, I'm here now. Kind of doubling down on it a little bit. He does get himself in some pickles, but he's got a big beating heart, Pat Cash.
Hmm.
He's a good person and a fantastic storyteller.
Yeah.
Fantastic storyteller.
We've all listened to that before this show, and we're all just sitting here hanging on every word. Matt, you don't know Pat like what we do, and you wouldn't have seen all of his years on the court and all that sort of thing. But, I mean, some of the stories he's telling there, you know, right at the start, the three courts on the centre court that they use for Kooyong, I mean, These are things that you, I mean, I think you see the video and you can see the courts on the sidelines, but I had no idea that they used them all like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And sneaking in as a kid and trying not to get found out. I just love that. And his recollections of those two tournaments are so clear. He clearly has played them back, thought about them. That line he gave about how when he goes back to Melbourne Park now, it kind of breaks his heart. That absolutely hit me in the gut when he said that. Completely reminded me of what Mary Carrillo said about John McEnroe and Roland Garros, how he still walks around there with a heaviness and with a weight, knowing that he never won it and let that lead slip against Lendl in 84. And I think we can think of these Grand Slam venues as full of brilliant memories, because those are the ones that we celebrate all the time. And you know, you all the slams have a parade of champions and whatever, but you know, they don't always invite back the former finalists, and they've got some tough memories in those places. Obviously he loves the Australian Open and everything about it, but I can imagine that it is difficult to keep returning there and keep playing back those moments in your mind where your life, your career could have been quite different if just something had gone your way. I was really moved by that.
And here in the UK, we perceive Pat Cash as somebody who had the ultimate moment. He won Wimbledon. You know, he was never a world number one. He was, you know, I find it interesting him saying there that he only qualified for the what's now the ATP finals, the once, you know, in terms of his ranking and consistency, winning that one Grand Slam and it being at Wimbledon. You know, that was a great crowning achievement for him, probably about par. But in Australia, I think he's perceived quite differently because he didn't win that home slam and because he lost in those two heartbreaking finals. It makes me think of what if Andy Murray had just won that 2012 US Open and had only ever lost in Wimbledon finals. And, you know, the way he would be perceived in this country would be completely different if he'd never won a Wimbledon. And obviously Pat's ended up spending, I know he returns to Australia a lot, still has a lot of family out there, but his main base is here in London, just down the road from me, in fact. Again, it comes back to the lost in time a little bit, and it really, really matters which one you win and when you win it. You know, it's not a hard and fast formula for what makes you linger in people's minds. And of course,
that's the thing, isn't it? Some things are massive in the moment. And he described the Davis Cup triumph at the time. That was just so big. And when we've watched back those highlights that I've watched today, the 87 and the 88 highlights, and the crowd are treating him like a rock star, aren't they? They're hanging on every single move he makes, and he was a huge figure. But that drifts in time, and as you say, I think when he walks into Wimbledon, he is probably stopped wherever he goes, because people still remember the black and white headband. They still remember the climbing into the stand. These are iconic images, and you've mentioned Andy Murray at Wimbledon, these sort of things. But we see a lot of ex-players who were a big deal back then. And you go to various venues and they can walk around without anybody noticing them.
I mean, Mats Wilander at Wimbledon.
Yeah.
You know, 7-time Grand Slam champion, you know, completely dominant for a period, won all three of the others. But at Wimbledon, he's not anonymous, but relatively so. There was a very, very controversial line there from Pat, re-artificial grass.
Yeah,
which elicited very different responses from Matt and David.
Yeah, I mean, I spent my life on artificial grass, me and Solihull Simon, who's now joined Twitter, by the way.
and his first act on Twitter, well, passive act on Twitter, was to have one of his tweets liked by Billie Jean King. Solihull Simon, if you're listening, that's not how Twitter generally goes. It's not
you've
like
peaked way the
first
too
day
soon.
Everyone joins, they get a tweet liked by Barack Obama or something. That's not how it happens.
No.
But hang on, you're not mentioning there that
I hate artificial grass.
And he's not the only one. I mean,
hang on. We're not finished with this story yet, David.
What?
Well, Matt hates it.
Well, yeah, he hates it because I love it and I could take him out on
it. But he still beat you on it.
No, we didn't play on artificial grass.
He played me on concrete. If he'd played me on my surface.
I've adjusted that memory in my head.
We played on a proper surface.
Yeah, ooh. It would have all been very different on that surface.
Right.
To be continued. I remember Judy Murray slagging it off as well. Apparently, do not let any pros or any wannabe pros grow up on it.
The thing is, it's really, just as Pat said, it's a really useful surface, especially yes. here, because you can play on it in the rain. And I just associate it with school tennis matches in the rain on a windy, cold day, and it just being a thoroughly miserable experience. Everything I don't want tennis to be, I associate with artificial grass surfaces.
And those are the conditions when we're having our rematch, Matt.
Gosh, we had very different school experiences, Matt.
What were yours?
Go on.
Tennis lessons at Kendrick Grammar School. I mean, artificial grass would have been the least of our problems.
Hmm. Grammar school? My comp... We would have had...
Still a state school.
You're having to patch up your net and ass.
Let's just say the athletic program wasn't its sort of main prong. forefront of the curriculum.
The lost in time element, fortunately, is somewhat solved by YouTube. And I'm very pleased to hear that Pat Cash is introducing his own style of tennis to his now pupil, his new pupil, Wong Chung, who's one of the top players in the world and who he's coaching now. And I mean, I wonder what she thinks. It'd be fascinating to know what she thinks when she sees him play tennis.
Have you seen those... YouTube videos of the teenagers that reacting to songs from like the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, they're great.
I haven't seen those.
They are so great. The one where they watch Phil Collins in the air tonight, and their reaction when the
when the drums come in. The best thing to do with that video is this is going to sound weird, is to play the video on mute, and you can still tell where the drums come in because their facial expressions change so dramatically.
It's really great. I can't remember what they're called or what the YouTube channel is, but a search of teenagers watch music.
Right. Okay.
To a barman and everything. They're like huge
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really big thing. But I can imagine that Wong Chung watching Pat Cash beat Lee Van Lendl in 1988 would have been the sort of tennis equivalent of that.
Come on.
I'd have liked to watch it.
He looks cool and he's so athletic.
Yeah.
No, they love it.
It's not a sneery thing at all.
Is it not? Oh,
no,
good.
No, it's lovely. It's really, really lovely.
Right, well, let's end this podcast. I want to go and find that.
No. It's really uplifting.
That's very good. Very good. Okay. I should tell you as well what I found when I went to Kooyong. I've only been once, and it was the first year I went to Australia to cover the Australian Open for BBC Radio. And I went probably a week earlier than I normally would these days, just because I wanted to see some of these places that I'd heard about, because Kooyong was the place. It was the pre-Australian Open tournament as I knew it. I hadn't really cottoned on that it used to stage the tournament itself, but it held, and Pete Sampras used to play. I remember in the 90s, Pete Sampras would play Kooyong as his warm-up event for the Australian Open, and it was just a series of exhibition tournament matches as it is today. But when I went and found it, I could not believe my eyes. With my 2003 eyes, used to what a Grand Slam tennis venue looks like, I couldn't believe that this place staged a Grand Slam tournament or used to, because it just it's like Pat's saying, it's just a little suburban tennis club to my mind. And even the centre court, I know they built stands that they wouldn't have for the exhibition, but even so, you cannot believe it. I mean, the clubhouse is absolutely beautiful. I have to say that it's classic old style celebration of the sport. It feels a little bit like I imagine the International Tennis Hall of Fame might look, trophies everywhere and a big celebration. But it's so much smaller than even I would have imagined.
Would it be like imagining a Grand Slam once having been held at Queen's?
Yes, I would say probably so. I would say Queen's, because I'm used to Queen's with all the stands up, that felt way bigger to me in 2003. I think when you take the temporary stands down that Queen's builds, it's more like that, yeah. Although I would say Queen's seems bigger and more grand, really, than Kooyong did, to just in terms of feel, at least. Beautiful place to go, though. And a really special experience to have witnessed it.
Twins the New Trend is the YouTube
oh, good.
Channel.
Right, fine. go on.
I was kind of amazed reading about this story and listening to Pat Cash there, just how seamless that transition appears to be. Other than the mix-up with the balls, everything you read is that it was just immediately just a huge success. And I think that's a feat in itself, because people are very reluctant to change, very resistant to change. And Kooyong had all this history, and to leave that behind, I imagine, was quite difficult. I imagine there was some trepidation as much as there was excitement about what Melbourne Park could bring. But
yeah, I think partly it's because they knew how necessary it was. Mm. But even so, you're right. I mean, when you think of all the football teams that we know that have moved from classic stadia and that they've grown up in and that they're always going to be linked to, you know, whether it's Highbury or Upton Park and all these, and then they move to these new, quite soulless stadia.
That's the word, isn't it?
There was none of that, really.
What are you trying to say about the Medeski, David?
That's the worst of the lot.
Oh my goodness.
You're going to move on. Pam Shriver was also there in 1987 and 1988, won the doubles with Martina Navratilova at both events. Let's hear what she remembers about Kooyong and then Melbourne Park.
Well, I kind of went through three stages of playing the Australian Open. The time I played in 1979, which was the year after I got the finals of the US Open at 16, I actually played four tournaments during the summer circuit in Australia, but went home for Christmas, which is when the Australian Open was being played. So I didn't even stay for the Australian Open, which now is crazy. I think that was a year either Chris O'Neill or Barbara Jordan won it. Okay, so then the next year, 1980, at Kooyong, the women's field became significantly tougher. Virtually everybody started to come down. It took a couple of years for the ATP to then join and play at full strength. But it was obvious, very similar to how the U.S. Open outgrew Forest Hills, that the Australian Open, if it was going to stay on the same level as the other three majors, needed to do something major. And they did. And they got the government to be their partner. They got away from a private club. I can remember in 86 and 87, it was a couple of years before we moved, they had us testing different surfaces. And it was this surface tried called Rebound Ace that was rubberized. I actually hated it. See, like I won 21 singles titles about half on grass. So like when there was not going to be grass courts on a second major, because the US Open had already moved away from grass, it was devastating to my grass court game, but it was the right decision for the Australian Open. And in 1988, when all the players walked into that facility, to see Rod Laver Arena with a roof that closed and to just see the beauty of that facility, it was really incredible.
Yeah, that surface, I've read a few quotes about how it seemed like the perfect equalizer for tennis, the most level playing field, if you like, for both styles of play. But there was also the element of how it seemed to become a little sticky in the real heat. What were your memories of playing on it?
Well, in 1988, a lot of people don't realize that the two lead-up tournaments, Brisbane and Sydney, were still played on grass. So, of course, what was I going to do? I was going to play both those. I actually won both the grass court lead-up tournaments because I'm like, I got to play these. There's no way. I don't care. I'll come in ill-prepared. And I'll remember flying from Sydney to Melbourne. And I think even the day I won the singles, we went just to go over for like a half hour hit. And it wasn't like your normal hard court, David. It was like your feet, you didn't pivot it. Well, just wasn't the same. So like I struggled a lot. I'm 6 foot one. I had the serve volley game. I found it extremely jarring. I didn't like it from the start, and I didn't have the best attitude about it either, because I think in my mind it was like, this surface is replacing grass. I think now the more traditional hard court surface is what you say. It's like this very neutral, equal surface for all. Anyone has a chance to win on it. But I wasn't a big fan of the rebound ace, and I can in my mind visualize so many sprained ankles, quite a few torn ACLs, because as it got hotter, it did get stickier.
Did the change of venue, Pam, did it change your perception of the tournament, the size of the tournament, the significance of winning it?
Well, Martina and I, we lost our first year at Kooyong, and then we actually won 7 straight Australian Open doubles. So it was we won our last couple of majors at Melbourne Park. I think 89 was our last of 20. So did it change? I'll tell you, it was definitely a bigger feel. It when you played on Rod Laver, even the doubles, it's a little bit like Wimbledon down there. They really do appreciate their doubles. And the first time when we won it in 88, it was pouring down rain. So there you have it. The roof was used for the first time in a major final. Actually, the singles final, I think it was played the next day between Groff and Everett, was an indoor Grand Slam singles final that Groff won fairly comfortably. So yes, Catherine, it had a very different feel from the little club at Kooyong that had like sheep or goats mowing the lawn up on the hills above the grass courts.
Bring back the sheep. That sounds great.
Yeah, it's fascinating to read up on it. And we had Billie Jean King as our guest on the podcast recently, And one thing she really got over to me that I don't think I fully appreciated was that the Grand Slams were not everything back then, or at least the Australian was particularly the poor relation, wasn't it?
Right, and that's why some of this conversation about Margaret Court's number of 24 is inflated so much with her, 11 Australians at a time when during a lot of those 11, not most of the top players didn't make the trip down. Using the example of my first Australian Open in 79, I mean, I was around the top 10 in the world. It had been a major finalist. I went home for Christmas to my family at age 17 instead of trying to win my first singles major. I mean, that's now it's just like, it sounds crazy, but that's what it was. So, you know, I have to give us, and the thing about the Australian Open through the years is, and now under the leadership of Craig Tiley for so many years, they just seem to make it bigger and better every year. They bring in, I think the US Open did it too, where they brought in like this whole entertainment part of it, where you came to a tennis tournament, but you also came to an entertainment event where you could listen to concerts and you could see radio shows with you could actually see the broadcasters in their little protective broadcast booths out on the grounds. Just when I think about walking around Melbourne Park, it's like, it's sensory overload, but it's a blast.
I missed that blast.
I think that pretty much sums it up, doesn't it? It's a blast. And yeah, we miss that. I love hearing her stories, and as Matt said halfway through that interview, the casual manner in which she says, "Yeah, we won the last 7 titles held at Kooyong." They were unbeatable. Yeah, I mean, between Pat and Pam, they've really summed up what an impressive feat it was to move to Melbourne Park and it to become what it is now. I think overall, I know Pat liked the rebound ace, and I enjoyed watching it. I think overall they've got it right now. The surface, and if you think about the rest of the stadia that they've built since then, okay, we may not like the name Margaret Court Arena, but the actual facility itself with the reclining roofs, having 3 of them, I mean, it is mightily impressive, Catherine, isn't it? I mean, you've been coming for the best part of a decade as well now. I mean, it's... Where does it stand out of all of them as a sort of venue?
For me personally,
mm.
top, I think. probably. Mm. So it's hard to argue with three roofs. I'm repeating myself to all regular tennis podcast listeners, but I find a night session to be the best thing in Grand Slam tennis, in tennis, really. So for me, it's between the Arthur Ashe Stadium and the Rod Laver Arena. Although, obviously, we did sort of experience a little taster of what night sessions are going to be like at the French Open. Hopefully warmer in the future. I won't judge them on what we've seen so far, so I'll add them into the mix in the future. But the watching experience on Rod Laver Arena is as good as any in tennis that I've experienced personally.
Mm. About you, Matt?
Yeah, it's number one for me. It feels like it incorporates the best elements of all the other slams and puts them together and just creates this wonderful tennis experience. And actually, reading up on it, it seems that is exactly what they did. There were a couple of architects who went to Wimbledon, went to the Roland Garros, went to the US Open, took the bits they liked, ignored the bits they didn't like. There was a funny line in a Sports Illustrated article that the architects didn't find much to like about Flushing Meadows, whereas they were enchanted by the landscaping at Roland Garros, and they loved the Royal Box at Wimbledon. The Rod Laver Arena's got a similar thing, but no, they in particular didn't like the steep steps and the long shadows cast on the court by the scoreboards at Flushing Meadows. And
this was pre-Arthur Ashe Stadium, though, of course.
Yeah. It was, yeah. But yeah, it has that feel to me, like the best of everything at Melbourne Park. I love what Pam was saying about this entertainment vibe. It does feel happy and like a festival. And they know they've got a good thing. You know, they've got the summer, they've got the start of the season, and yet they don't sit on that. They're constantly trying to improve and make it better, and I really do admire that.
Has anyone ever died of FOMO before?
Let's not test it out.
No, and they're not about to.
I think I am.
No.
Yeah, it's right now, as we're about a week and a half away from what will be the Australian Open, we are missing that prospect enormously.
I am, because I'm a very small person, I am dreading the day that all those tennis players get released and we just get smug posts.
You say
about
you want them to have a rubbish
glorious
time.
No, I don't. I want to be a bigger person that can be happy for them.
You just want to be there. I just
want to be there.
Join in is basically what are you saying?
Yeah.
Oh well, next year hopefully we can go back. I know there's more to it than this, but I mean, look, Andy Murray desperately wanted to go, didn't he?
He wanted to compete. Like we should set up a support group.
He's missing out, as we know. We touched on it a couple of weeks ago, and that's been confirmed now. He's not going to play the Australian Open this year, and he's just devastated.
He's frozen out.
Yeah. Gutted for him.
That was his caption on his obligatory snowman Instagram post. Yeah. Frozen out of the Australian Open. Yeah. I feel you.
I think we're still going to enjoy it when it's all on our TV screens. We're going to be buzzing. Daily podcasts we're going to be doing for you, and we hope you're going to enjoy them. But we've still got a couple more editions of Tennis Relived to come for you this week. And we're going to be bringing you 1995 in a couple of days' time. Pete Sampras's Tears and all that. And then we've got 2017 to revel in on Friday. Am I missing anything else, folks? Any other contributions before we go?
Maybe a word for the, as Pam alluded to, that 1988 Australian Open, significant in so many ways. One of those ways is the start of Steffi Graf's golden calendar slam. She only lost, I was reading, she only lost 13 games in the first four rounds of that tournament. Then she beat Hannah Mandlikova 6-2, 6-2. Then she won her semi-final 6-2, 6-3. And then she led Chris Evert 6-1, 5-1 in the final before Evert had a bit of a comeback and made that second set competitive in her last ever Grand Slam final. But, just incredible. And Janine Thompson, her second-round opponent, summed up the experience of playing Steffi Graf, saying, "Well, we'd only played one game when I asked myself, what the hell am I going to do?"
I think I did know on some level that was the final that year, but I don't think of Steffi Graf and Chris Evert overlapping at all. That's amazing.
Mm, yes, that Steffi Graf being so young and Chris Evert.
Steffi, she was 18 when she did that calendar Golden Slam. Yeah. Well, she can't have been 18 for all of it.
No, not unless her birthday is very early in January.
Yeah. But I remember seeing them play, and I think Chris Evert did get one win over Steffi Graf, maybe more than one in the early parts of the career. But when they played, it did feel like they were playing slightly different sports, just because the eras moved on very vividly in front of your eyes at that point. But yeah, you're quite right, Matt. That's important to touch on. But it was... It's great that there is footage out there that you can look back on at that special change in time, really, from Kooyong to Melbourne Park. We've enjoyed reliving it. We hope you have enjoyed it as well. Hello to Cookie, who is our pet mascot for this week. And also hello to Rogue. I think Catherine wants to say hello to somebody as well. Who's that, Catherine?
Zeus,
right, Zeus. And Matt's going to say hello to...
the one and only Scousel Mousel, of course.
And we'll also say hello to Chris Albert Lee, who's our executive producer and top bloke. Any shout-outs, Matt?
Yes, for Anthea Young.
Like Anthea Turner.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit like Althea.
Yes. Indeed. Indeed.
By the way, everybody, my son's just started printing his homework as I come to you, so if you can hear something in the background, homeschooling has entered Tennis Free Lives.
He just sauntered in, Yvonne Goolagong style.
Yeah. But less effectively.
For Christine Marlowe.
Oh, hello Christine. I often get called Christine when people get my name wrong. Caroline and Christine,
And Marlowe, that's your neck of the woods, isn't it?
Almost. Yes. Yes. Isn't that where Kate Middleton went to school?
I don't know.
No idea.
There's a famous girls' school there, I'm sure. Anyway, very, very nice,
And finally, for Matthias Caro.
Hang on, you said there were four?
No, I said there were shout-outs for the following people.
He's too good for us, Catherine. Matthias.
Hello, Matthias.
Great. It's always three. It's always three shots.
Okay. Matthias is a bit like that, the Albion player Matthias Pereira, who is just an amazing player.
My brother had a German exchange student called Matthias or Matthias that came to us when my brother would have been about 14, so I would have been about 11. Yeah, it was a weird bloke.
I much prefer ours, don't you?
He used to sit all day. It was when we had one family PC, and it was in a sort of communal area, and he spent the whole week just on that PC playing the flight simulator and doing his own sound effects. Like plane sound effects.
That's a weird experience when the student is normal.
Yeah.
That's an uncomfortable week anyway.
Yeah, I refused to do my French exchange because just anxiety about it was too high. And my parents supported me in that decision, so I can only assume they were also scarred by Matthias.
But
great name, though.
Matthias, thank you so much for your support of the podcast. And thankfully, you're way better than Catherine's exchange student.
Not mine, my brother's.
You don't happen to remember your German exchange student surname, do you? It wasn't Caro, was it?
I will check in with my brother and see if he can remember. I mean, Math had to go and stay with Matthias, and I'll check in for further Matthias stories.
Excellent. Right. Okay. Well, enough of that. We'll be back in a couple of days. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, Pam Shriver and Pat Cash, enormously, because it was just so great to hear their stories. Hope you're enjoying this series of Tennis Relived. We'll be back in a couple of days.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.